I was so excited to read your biography of Lin-Manuel Miranda, but this is my only disappointment. I searched in vain for the aha light bulb moment where Lin-Manuel saw Rap Othello in the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged and went, aha!
I'm glad that you picked up on the subtext that I think was running through every page of the book.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 971, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Our old friend Daniel Pollack Pelsner's new book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist, comes out on September 9th, 2025, just under 2 months from now. I've read an early copy, and it's a fantastic story about an artist who has learned from almost everyone he's ever met and incorporated it into his art. Daniel says in his introduction that one of the reasons he wrote the book is because he, quote, wanted to find out what Lin-Manuel had learned. I knew his output. I was curious to figure out his input. I loved reading Daniel's book, and I love getting to share our conversation about it with you. You had me in your prologue when you said that Lin-Manuel had realized, in other words, that artistic genius is a team sport, which that idea of collaboration and that nothing happens in a vacuum is absolutely 100% true, and I don't know why that is so newsworthy.
Well, of course, you know this, Austin, as a creator in the theater, and I think everybody who works in the theater knows it's a collaborative art form, but we still seem to be, I think, sort of attached to these notions of individual genius and our vision as of the writer working alone in a garret and then coming up with the muse strike of inspiration and going out to
and handing the text down to mere actors. Go say these words and it'll be fine.
Exactly. Yes. And there certainly are scenes of Lin, usually it's less handing the text than emailing a demo file and people being thrilled at it. But so much of his work has been figuring out how to enlist the talents of the people around him to create something that he couldn't on his own. And he's very, I think, very generous and consistent in crediting those mentors back, you know, all the way to his elementary school bus driver through Stephen Sondheim and Tommy Gale and Alex Lacamoire and all the other people that his fans know about. And my pitch to him actually was really a book to put a spotlight on the teachers, mentors, and collaborators who help him create his work to argue for the thesis that you were just describing, Austin, that masterpieces just don't spring fully formed into the world, but emerge from the interactions between an artist and their environment. And he said that was what attracted him to participating in the project, too.
Well, and it's a fantastic pitch, and it seems to speak to the man that he wants to celebrate, not the work that I've done, but the inspirations that I have had that have made the work that I do possible.
That's exactly right. I think it's a somewhat unique artist whom his fans can actually, many of them know the name of his elementary school music teacher, Barbara Ames, who cast him as Conrad Birdie in the sixth grade play and gave him his dose of stardom, or can rattle off the comments that Dr. Herbert, his eighth grade English teacher, made on the back of an essay that spurred him to join the student-run theater club. That these are actually sort of stages in the canonical development of the artist, as well as you know, lyrics to My Shot or to Moana.
Well, and I was, obviously, I make these connections all the time because I write these articles for the Folger,
yes.
But you also say in your prologue that you said you're trained as a Shakespeare scholar and you wondered who our Shakespeares might be today.
Yeah.
You know, I think of Stephen Sondheim and August Wilson as sort of the two biggest, and both of whom are collaborative theater artists in the same breath as Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yes. Well, you are describing the origin story of this book, Austin. So I had been working on a piece a decade ago, back in 2015 for The New Yorker, about really writers who are writing history plays on the scope of Shakespeare's history plays, and asking who's telling our big national stories with an inclusive cast and an innovative form. And I had been writing at the time about Lynn Nottage and Chiara Allegria Hudes, who had worked at the Public Theater. And when I interviewed Oscar Eustace, the head of the Public, he said, well, you should also, if you're thinking about our Shakespeare's today, you should take a look at this guy who's writing a hip-hop retelling of the American Revolution. He, if I'm remembering rightly, Oscar Eustace said, it's no Rapafello, but it's the next best thing.
Very kind.
As it happened, the show was just transferring from the Public to previews on Broadway, and we were going from Portland, Oregon, where I live, to New York to celebrate my grandma's 90th birthday. And we had one night free in New York where we had babysitting, and my wife offered to take me out. And grandma had taken us to see In the Heights back in 2008, because grandma grew up in Washington Heights over her immigrant father's kosher deli. And she remembered the history of different waves of immigration in the neighborhood. And when Usnavi says, you know, at the bar with drinks, as long as you buy them, l'chaim, I remember grandma in tears at that moment. So Lin-Manuel was on my radar, but not that much on my radar. So when my wife said, we've got one night out, I can take you to a fancy dinner, Daniel, or I can take you to see this new thing, Hamilton, in previews, I said immediately, fancy dinner, of course. That's what sounds appeals to me. But it was grandma who said, no, Daniel, Hamilton is going to be the next thing. You need to go see it. And since it was previews, it was still easy to get tickets. We went to see it. And that night, Joe Biden, who was then Obama's vice president, was sitting down the aisle from us, Secret Service clogging the lobby, going to the bathroom at intermission was a huge pain. But watching him watch the origin story of American democracy, I thought, God, this is as close as I could get to watching Macbeth next to King James.
Wow.
Like, this is the performance of American power for American power. And I felt I'd missed the first 400 years of Shakespeare reception history, but I can be here on the ground level for this origin story of America. And so I became kind of a groupie. I went to London when Hamilton opened in the West End there and wrote about what happens when the American Revolution goes to the shadow of Buckingham Palace. And I went to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria to write about Lin-Manuel bringing the show there and returning the title role as a way to help the island recover. And got to interview then Lin-Manuel a couple of times, and was always struck with him talking about his projects based on what he could learn from the people he was collaborating with. And then it was actually James Shapiro, who's become a wonderfully generous mentor to me. I was at a moment of professional transition, and he said, Daniel, you need to write a book. Nobody cares about Shakespeare anymore. Write a book about that guy, Lin-Manuel, that you've been stalking around the globe for the next last decade. And I thought, well, I don't want to write something just praising him. He has plenty of laurels already. I don't want to write a takedown. What I'd really love to write is something that my students could use, a story of how he learned to be an artist that could be of use for the students I have when I teach theater and teach English, who want to have a life in the arts, are often trying to reconcile their parents' cultural legacies with their own artistic aspirations. And I thought, this is not going to be a blueprint, but it'll be a mindset that Lin-Manuel exhibits that perhaps could help other people who want to learn to be artists too.
I'm Peter Holland. I'm the McNeil Family Professor in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2025, we'll be touring all the great books abridged at various venues we'll announce soon, and the ultimate Christmas show abridged in Washington State at the Edmonds Center for the Arts on December 3rd and the Capitol Theater in Yakima on December 12th. Sign up for our newsletter or check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Daniel Pollack Pelsner, talking about his new book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist, which comes out on September 9th. Daniel was talking about how he first approached Lin-Manuel with his book proposal.
I had done a profile for the New Yorker of Chiara Alegria Hudes, Lynn's writing partner for In the Heights. And I had asked Chiara, this was back in 2017, can I talk to some of your collaborators about working with you? And within 5 minutes, I got an email from Lin-Manuel saying, hey, you're writing about Chiara, so lucky you. What do you want to know? And I was thrilled. He signed it Siempre Lin-Manuel. Little did I know that's how he signs all his emails, but I thought, oh, he now understands that we will always be correspondents. <Yeah. laughs> And he wrote, well, I've sent him questions. He wrote back the most fabulous quotes about Chiara that we used for the piece. So I had his email. That was helpful in being able to approach him. I'd just done a piece about his dad for The Atlantic as well. And as you may recall, I had written a little bit about Mary Poppins Returns when that came into the cultural conversation. So and that was a slightly more critical piece. So I think he knew we had some balance. But the other thing that was just serendipitous that I hadn't quite realized was that we're basically the same age. He's 6 months younger, and so I went to college with a bunch of his friends from Hunter High School that he attended in New York. So my singing group in college had people who were in his a cappella group in high school. And in fact, his high school girlfriend was in a play with me, a Shakespeare play. We were in As You Like It together our freshman year. I was, Lord number three over in the corner. She was Celia, one of the leads, because she was a pro coming out of the Hunter College High School drama program. And so I think when we figured out these connections, he knew that I wasn't a totally unknown quantity. And he was tremendously generous at that our first meeting at the Drama Bookshop. I told him, if I'm going to write this book, I need to be able to talk to you many times. I need your folks to open up their vault in their storage cabinet of everything that you created in elementary school and on. And I need to be able to talk to everybody that you would consider a teacher. And so we came up with a list, and I kept adding to the list. And then his folks would sort of clear the way and say, okay, this person's coming in to talk. And then there were some people I reached out to on my own. And Lynn told me his actual favorite part of this whole process was hearing from friends he hadn't been in touch with since high school saying, some guy named Daniel Pollack Pelsner reached out to me. Is he legit?
Yeah.
And Lynn said he would always write back, say, yeah, he's legit. But he felt sort of protected by a web of love going back to his childhood days of folks who cared about him and were very excited for the most part to be a part of his story and to be included, let me be a part of the narrative. And so they were wonderfully generous in that.
Well, and it's the list of folks that you talked to is vast. The time period you're covering is vast. And yet, unlike many biographies, this doesn't have that boring bit at the beginning where you're talking about his roots or whatever. It's all framed and the story is told so compellingly. I guess my question is, from a nuts and bolts standpoint, how did you manage to cut the boring parts and elide over the long stretches where nothing was happening? How difficult was that?
Well, you're very kind to frame it that way, Austin, and I'll give all credit to my first round of editors, who were my kids at the dinner table, and through the 3 years of researching this book, at the end of the day, make dinner, they come home, they sit down, and I say, guys, you won't believe it. I just found out that Stephen Sondheim visited Lynn's high school drama club in 1998. And my teenage daughter looked at me and said, "Ooh, Dad, you should put that in a folder called Nobody Cares."
Oh,
that was always the first level of interest. Is could I get past instinctive teenage derision to something that would be repeated later on?
I'm happy to say, spoiler alert, that story did make it into the book because people do care.
That's true. But the poster that Lin-Manuel hung on his freshman dorm room, which I was very excited to learn about, did not make the threshold. So there was a winnowing process. And I remember my agent saying to me after she read the first draft of the book that was 100,000 words longer than the version that was published, she said, "Daniel, I'm so grateful to have gotten to read this because I know once it's edited, no one else will have to." So that was part of the process going in. But I felt, as you did, that I ugh, I groan when I have to wade through six generations of a family in order to get to the parts that I want. So yeah. I tried to really keep the lens on what, this is a book about the education of an artist. What is Lin-Manuel learning in each chapter? And any exposition is going to be sort of backfilled once we know what the excitement is.
It does give you a wonderful thread, you know, a plot, I guess, you know, to scrape away, tear away all the stuff that doesn't tell that story, the specific story that you're telling. I assumed that this was the first biography of Lin-Manuel Miranda, but it's is it?
Well, I think it's the first the first one that's involved extensive interviews and his collaboration. He did, when I met with him, he said, "You've been scooped," and he showed me this little like kids, you know, who was Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of thing. So I think there have, I suppose there have been others in that category. But I did feel a little bit of a tension of like, okay, it's the first major book coming out from a major house with the participation of the subject. Part of me wanted to include everything.
Sure.
And what I had to just keep in mind, my refrain was Coast Guard, because you might remember one line in Hamilton where Aaron Burr said, "How did Hamilton, the short-tempered protean creator of the Coast Guard, right, founder of the New York Post, ardently abuse his cabinet post?" Uh-huh. Like, those are two things about Hamilton that could be their own act of a show, creating the Coast Guard and founding the New York Post. But Lin-Manuel exercised that editorial discretion to say those are very cool and significant things that he did that are not part of the story we're telling. So every time I got to, wait, but he also wrote songs for Star Wars, or he also collaborated on a musical with John Kander, I just had to tell myself, Coast Guard. We will briefly mention those things, but if he's not learning something new through the process of working on it, then it can't be part of the story.
I also get the sense from your book that his wife, Vanessa, exercises the same editorial control as your daughter at the dinner table.
Vanessa is amazing. She's a lawyer and a scientist, and maybe the most self-possessed person I think I've ever encountered. She totally loves her husband and has zero interest in his work, as far as I could tell. she would say, like, he'll come home at the end of the day, and just like with my daughter, and she'll say, or he'll tell her, "Oh my God, I met Jay-Z today, and I talked with Bobby Lopez about this key change," and she'll say, "And I care why."
Oh my God.
And so I think Hamilton fans know the story perhaps of Lin-Manuel writing the first version of Eliza's song in Hamilton, what would eventually become Helpless, but was called This One's Mine in the first draft. And he was excited about it. He played it for Vanessa, and she said, "This isn't your final version." And he told me he steamed for a little bit. Then he went back to Jeffrey Sellers' gazebo and redid it in the style of Beyonce, and it came out much better. Vanessa actually read a draft of my book as well and gave me 300 pages of legalistic line notes on it, which was
wow.
Both very intimidating and also an amazing act of generosity on her part. Yeah. And I thought, wow, this is what it's like to be on the receiving end of a Vanessa edit. She's given me the gift of knowing what it could be like to be Lin-Manuel getting a draft back from her.
That's incredible.
Very rigorous.
Well, but it speaks to this. It speaks to that thing that we all need as artists and writers and creators, editors, you know, people who tell us, people who aren't impressed by us, who can say, you don't need this, or this needs help, or whatever. And we're lucky if we have those people in our lives.
Well, that was something I felt like I really learned as a writer from writing about Lin-Manuel's writing process, that I tended to be, before this book, I would say, quite precious about my writing, and I wouldn't put a sentence down unless I thought it could be chiseled in stone on the, the pediment of the Parthenon. And I didn't really like changing it once I'd put it down. But reading learning, interviewing folks and hearing from Lin and seeing the many iterations that work that I love went through in order to become work that I love freed me up quite a bit to think, okay, I just need to get something down at first, and then I'm going to trust in the process that Lin has with his collaborators, which is he'll write his first version and then he'll share it with Alex Lacamoire, his music arranger, Tommy Kail, his director, Andy Blankenbuehler, his choreographer, almost always Vanessa as well, his first and toughest editor. And he'll say, in essence, he told me that his phrase was, here's what was in my head, what came across to you, and how do I shorten that gap? How do I make my intention match your effect? And so I would see, he shared with me these Dropbox folders of the iterations of songs. So a song, maybe my favorite song in his canon is Nina's song, the heroine's song from In the Heights called Breathe, where she talks about her insecurity as a first generation Latina student going to college and wondering whether she'll fit in and whether she'll make her neighborhood proud. And I think it's a beautiful sort of confession of somebody who has a lot of expectations put on them that is just perfect in form. And that was about the 15th version of that song that Lynn had written for the heroine's I Want slot. First, it was this fun number called I Fell in Love on a Saturday, and then it became Latinas Are Sizzling Hot, a song about wishing you had a J-Lo booty and not fitting up to cultural stereotypes, and then it became a song called Almost Home, and it went through so many versions to become the perfect version. And that helped me as a writer see, okay, I don't have to get it right the first time. I'll put it down and I will trust in the collaborative process to have it come out better by the end of the process.
Making it look easy ain't easy. That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Comedy podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Daniel Pollack Pelsner's new book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist, comes out on September 9th, 2025. It's available for pre-order now at all bookstores, and if you live in the UK and pre-order from Waterstones, you have the chance to win two tickets to Hamilton at the Victoria Palace Theatre in London. I'll include a link to that Waterstones offer in this episode's show notes at our website. Send us your most influential teacher or colleague via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com, or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareance.com. Thanks, as always, to Voice of a Generation, at least on his block, Matthew Croak. Web services by Ginger Power Limited. Music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Haley Jardas. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Peter Holland, the chair of the International Shakespeare Association and outgoing professor of Shakespeare at the University of Notre Dame. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 971 2913ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. God, I really hope James Shapiro is wrong about people not caring about Shakespeare anymore. Maybe he just didn't want the competition. But were there more parallels, Shakespearean parallels in your book from between Lin-Manuel and Will that you excised?
Oh, yes. So this was one of my favorite ones that probably would only be of interest to somebody like you and your listeners, Austin. But this is in the Hamilton trivia category. So I don't know if you had the reaction like I did, seeing Hamilton for the first time and getting to the moment in Act Two when Hamilton is writing to his sister-in-law Angelica overseas, and he writes, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creep in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, right? What is it? I trust you'll understand the reference to another Scottish tragedy without my having to name the play. And those of us who are Shakespeareans, the audience, right, thrill at self-congratulation that we recognize the reference to another Scottish tragedy, and it continues on. So I knew from talking to Oscar Eustace that was not the original quote that Lin-Manuel had used at that moment in the show. In the first version at workshops at the Public, he had Hamilton write to Angelica, I am tied, am I going to get the quote right? You might be able to correct me. I am tied to the stake and something like bear-like must stay the course. I trust you'll understand the reference to another Scottish tragedy without my having to cite the source. Somewhat obscure Macbeth line. And Oscar Eustace said, he was the director of the New York Shakespeare Festival. He didn't know that line. Could you please substitute something more recognizable? So that part is known Hamilton lore. You can read that in the annotations to the Hamilton libretto. But I wondered, now Lin-Manuel is not a Shakespeare scholar. How did he happen to know I am tied to the stake and cannot fly? This sort of reference to Macbeth entrapped by his enemies like a bear being tied to the stake in a cruel bear-baiting spectacle. How would Lin have known that line to put it in? So I asked him, and he said in his elementary school English unit, they had to do a project on Macbeth, and they had to take a scene from Macbeth and add some original, I think they had to perform it or add some original lines to it. And he and his friend chose the shortest scene that they could find so that they would have the easiest time on the project, which was this tiny little scene in Act 5 where Macbeth encounters young Seward when he's looking for the person who's going to fulfill the no man of woman born prophecy and ends up killing, I think, young Seward. But it was just because it was not because of his comprehensive knowledge of Macbeth. It was because of his attempt to find the shortest scene in Macbeth to do for his project that he happened to know the bear baiting line. And that was the line that stuck with him years and years later.
I love that he and I have the same instincts as Lin-Manuel Miranda, which is to pick the shortest, easiest Shakespeare things to make fun of.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.